Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Good to talk to you again, as always.
I fear this might be a tense day in the DMZ.
Well, you know, a tense day in the DMZ is a moderate day in other places. So we'll deal with it as we go. What do you want to start with?
I'll save the hard stuff for later. Let's ease into the day. You had a fantastic star turn on Morning Joe yesterday, because your column about the Republican Party losing young Christians is, you know, probably one of the hottest columns, you know, in the national dialogue this week. And I just wanted you to sum that up for folks so we can talk about it some more.
Well, thank you very much. First, I was on Morning Joe yesterday, and it's always awesome to talk about something you actually wrote. And a lot of times, you know, commentators come on to talk about news of the day, or in some cases, things that you have to, like, prep for. You've never even written about it. So it's, like, really an honor to get to talk about, you know, do a whole segment on something you wrote. And I've had that opportunity on multiple occasions on Morning Joe, and I really appreciate that opportunity. It's so cool. So the piece essentially argues that that there's always been this tension between the city of God and the city of man, and that there's always been this thing where it's dangerous for people of faith to become involved in politics because it's an insidious, corrupting force. And in fact, you know, until like the late 1970s, a lot of evangelicals wouldn't get involved in politics because they feared this exact thing. But because of situations like Roe versus Wade and conservative activists wooing them, they helped form the Reagan Coalition and later the Christian Coalition. But now we see this trend where their children, the millennial evangelical generation, are really turned off to politics. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that all of them are going to leave the Republican Party, but some of them did support Obama because he really tapped into that, the rhetoric of the Joshua generation and am I my brother's keeper. He was very good at that and obviously inspirational to young people. But I don't think it's a matter of them leaving the GOP en masse as much as it's a matter of them tuning out of politics and focusing on, you know, poverty and AIDS in Africa, and maybe the life issue too. But that's devastating to a Republican Party who needs them as their ground troops. There's several reasons why this is happening today more than even a generation ago. One thing is, I think the movement of the Republican Party and the conservative movement toward a more libertarian, less socially conservative direction. The other thing, I think, is the fact that the right, since Obama's election, has really been aping the left. And what I mean is that rather than holding the Bible as their Bible, or rather than looking to statesmen like my hero William Wilberforce as an example, they're actually looking to Saul Alinsky, a leftist Chicago organizer who inspired Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in many ways. They're looking to this guy whose message was essentially the end justifies the means, just win, baby, mock the other side mercilessly. And it's this sort of hardball politics that I think it turns off some young Christians who sit in pews on Sundays and they hear, love thy neighbor, do unto others as you would have, you know, do unto others, turn the other cheek, all of these messages. And then they come out and they get on Twitter, they go to volunteer on a campaign, and they see very un-Christ-like behavior. This is something that Christians must struggle with. That's what the piece was about.
I mean, certainly, you know, I mean, I think the essence of Alinsky is, a lot of direct confrontation, you know, outside agitation. Do you think that that kind of horrible attitude is all that new? I mean, I think there's certain Alinsky tactics that, you know, folks like, I can't remember his name anymore, the Acorn guy, O'Keefe, yeah, something he did where he was openly in his blog posting saying he was following the Alinsky model, with those sort of tactics. But there are other hardball things that Republicans have done over the past 30 years, haven't there? Or do you think this is all that different?
Well, I do think it's different. I mean, first, Bill, you know, you're right. Politics is not beanbag, and it's always been tough. And there have always been, you know, Lee Atwaters who practiced this sort of politics. I think the difference was that the hashtag war that's become popularized on Twitter, you know, politics is a bloodless war. The warfare used to be done by people who put on a uniform. And what I mean by that is they signed up to be a candidate, they signed up to be a campaign manager, they volunteered on a campaign, whatever. They were in the war, and they had a uniform on. The fighting now is more asymmetrical. Anybody who gets on Twitter can enter this sort of asymmetrical warfare, which means it's easy for the average person who just dips his toe into politics to be seduced by this. And I do think there's something different. I do think that the message today is, look, the left, and by the way, let me just say, it's irrelevant whether or not this is true, but the sense is, on the right, the left is willing to lie, cheat, and steal and do whatever it takes to win elections. We have to be just as tough as them. We have to be just as bad as them. And, you know, it's the whole line, they bring a gun, or they bring a knife, we pull a gun, they put one of ours in the hospital, we put one of theirs in the morgue. That's really what the message is. And so you've had a lot of young conservatives who are basically saying, let's study the left, let's study their tactics. Now, on one hand, I can understand and appreciate this. I mean, know thy enemy as thyself. You know, General Patton read Rommel's book. You know, the famous line, Rommel, you brilliant bastard, I read your book, or whatever, from the movie. I'm paraphrasing. But there's something healthy and actually, I would say, humble about learning from the other side. The problem that I worry about is, at some point, if you are emulating the left and copying their behavior, you really become the left. You become no different than them. And so we see it happening right now. My friend Ben Shapiro is a good example. I like Ben a lot. Really good guy. Incredibly smart young guy. But he has now started an effort, or he's helping lead an effort, to boycott sponsors of Al Sharpton. This is an example of conservatives doing what the left has been. Now, I think boycotts, I'm not a fan of boycotts. I don't want my life to be about bitching and complaining and boycotting things. To me, that's what the left does. They're great at being victims. So I would say, look, I'm not going to do that. I became a conservative because I don't like that bullshit. But people like Ben, and I think they have a point, they say, look, you got to fight fire with fire. If the left is going to do boycotts, we have to do boycotts. If the left is going to do ambush interviews, we have to do ambush interviews. That they will say this is a war. Now, I will say, don't look to Saul Alinsky. Look to other people who are more noble and more virtuous. But this is a huge fight right now taking place. I think it's not just on the right, but certainly on the right. And it's a big debate. And I think some people probably think that, you know, that what I'm saying is a weak, wimpy, losing philosophy.
Well, what I find interesting about this is, I don't accept all the, I don't accept the premise that the left is a lie, cheat, and steal.
Right, I'm sure you might not. Yeah.
I don't think that's accurate. But what I find interesting here is that the right is, both sides, when they're down, look to the winning side to see what are those guys doing right, and let's try to copy that. I mean, the left was doing plenty of that in the Bush days. And I think to some degree found some things that the conservatives were doing that were working well and stepped up their game. And I think surpassed their game in certain respects. I feel the right now is sort of looking at anything the left has done over the past you know, 50 years and have just sort of grabbed at stuff. You know, boycotting,
protests,
boycotting's the lamest stuff the left does.
Yeah.
Boycotting is not why Obama got to be president. That, why copy that? You know, we've been boycotting Rush Limbaugh for years. He's still around. And well, let's have protests the way the left does protests. Protests almost never work. You know, it's a very, you march on Washington and, you know, the immigrant rally of 2006. So that's about it. You know, most protests are giant failures.
If part of the reason you became a conservative is you don't like whining, you don't like the politics of victimhood, you don't like these tactics, you don't like the protests and the boycotts, you think that's silly. If that's part of the reason why you're a conservative, then you don't have a home anymore, because this is an arms race now.
Well, I mean, I think you're looking at it as if your starting point is Alinsky, that there's something kind of morally corrosive about that.
I think there is something bad about being uber political. And, I mean, look, I read Rules for Radicals 15 years ago, long before a lot of the Tea Party folks were into it. And it is a pessimistic, negative worldview that is sort of nihilistic. Essentially, this life is all there is. You got to get everything you can while you can, using whatever means necessary. And I reject that premise.
Well, I think the premise there, I feel, is it's about getting power. Right. That was sort of a
Machiavellian.
But specific to Alinsky, I think it's not correct to say that all of the left are Alinskyites. I mean, I think Alinsky's view of power is actually somewhat atypical amongst left. A lot of the left is very squeamish about power. I mean, Occupy is kind of the opposite of Alinsky. Let's all have a big giant drum circle and we'll make collective decisions together. That's not what Alinsky does. You know, Alinsky is about, you know, causing a degree of disruption to make individual people in power manifestly uncomfortable, so you gain leverage in an inevitable negotiation. In fact, I mean, Alinsky is actually quite praiseworthy of compromise, but he uses outside agitation. So if you are not currently in an elective office type of position, you would have leverage in such a negotiation and get some chunk of what you want. And, you know, a lot of the left is far less focused and ends oriented than that.
No, I
and
completely I feel, agree. Look, you can't pretend that he's like, you know, the end all and be all. But I would say it is fair to say. And by the way, you know, you get up at 5 a.m., you go on TV, on live TV with the bright lights. I made a couple errors yesterday on TV. And one of the things I said was, I said that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, well, first I said he died in the 1970s, which is true, 1972, Alinsky. But then I said Hillary and Obama studied at his feet. People took that to mean literally, and I guess it implies that they literally were his disciples. That's not the case, but Hillary Clinton did write her thesis on him, and Barack Obama was a Chicago community organizer who certainly studied him and learned from Alinsky's protege. So my point here, aside from the fact that I should have been more precise on air, is that despite the fact I agree with you that, you know, you can't make too much of Alinsky, it is fair to say that arguably the two most important Democrats in America today were keenly aware of Alinsky and were quite, in fact, students of his work. That is a big deal.
I think that's true, but I don't. I mean, like, I'm not anti Alinsky. I mean, my personal preference, Alinsky tactics generally work. So, I think they're
well. That's what the conservatives are. That is exactly what my conservative friends say.
I think whether a tactic is good or bad is not the same whether it's moral or immoral. I mean, you can use those tactics to good ends or bad ends. But I think both Hillary Clinton and Obama have not been Alinskyites in practice. You know, they're not outside agitators. They've worked inside the system and not tried to challenge the system from the outside. I think they've pursued totally different paths in their lives. And well, secondly, just to finish one
I'm
point,
sorry.
I think conservatives have kind of took of the conservatives you're talking about have kind of taken half the Alinsky lesson. You know, they've done the confrontation outside agitation part, but they've forgotten that the it caps off with getting to the table with the increased leverage you have won and accepting. You know, he praises getting 30% of what you want, not even half a loaf. He was like 30% of what you want is 30% towards your goal, and I think the conservative Tea Party right here is all been very all or nothing, which is not Alinsky at all, and I think it's undermined their it undercuts the entire strategy.
All right, well, I want to go back to the whole point about tactics, though. Look, on one hand, I agree that political technology is philosophically neutral. As Mayor LaGuardia said, there's no Republican way to pick up the trash. So there's nothing wrong with, you know, conservatives learning how to go door to door more effectively during a political campaign. There's nothing wrong with conservatives or liberals learning how to do a voter ID or voter turnout more effectively and studying the other side. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, I do think there's a difference, though, when, you know, part of conservatism is to not be hyper-political, to not be constantly focused on politics. And I think that there is a problem when your tactics could overcome your other philosophy. And so if you are obsessing, spending all of your time obsessing on agitation, on protesting things, on following people with cameras and mocking them and getting them to say something stupid, on, boycotting things. I mean, these are, you know, incredibly, I think, soul-crushing activities to base your life and your career around. Even if you believe that it's for the good, that you're fighting the good fight, I mean, that's not the life that I want. And I think it would be very hard for a person to dedicate their lives to such activities and to really be a temperamentally, you know, conservative, well-rounded, grounded person, and in fact, a good Christian, I would say, or whatever your faith tradition. So, look, I think at some point you are no better than what you do. Your habits determine who you are as a person. And so I think that at some point tactics do matter and they do affect your worldview and your philosophy.
Well, you're getting into a very sort of deep philosophical place.
That's what I do, Bill.
Which is fine. I'm just trying to crystallize it. So correct me if I'm not crystallizing it correctly. I mean, you're basically saying that there's a way. I mean, let me backtrack a little bit. My understanding is there was a period of time in the 60s and 70s where a lot of fundamentalist evangelical Christians said politics is sort of an inherently heathenous,
right.
And it is not a clean place for us to participate in and be closer to God. We're gonna just focus on our own business and leave politics to those miscreants. And that began to shift with Jimmy Carter's campaign, where he made more open faith appeals and brought evangelicals into the process, which then Jerry Falwell and Ronald Reagan then did a better job capturing with the moral majority, and that evolved into the Christian Coalition and other forms since then.
Right.
And that was a big, you know, theological leap to make, that it's okay for Christians, for fundamentalist Christians, to engage in the dirty life of politics. You can still be clean and get involved. And what I find interesting about what you're saying is you are half rejecting the dirty aspect of politics, the power-hungry aspect of politics, but you're not saying that evangelicals and fundamentalist Christians should remove themselves from politics entirely. You're trying to find some kind of sweet spot.
Yeah.
And I guess my question is, how do you define that sweet spot?
Okay, so let me finish the story. You're absolutely right in your history, and you stopped at Ronald Reagan. what happened then was Christian conservatives who had been skeptical of politics, but now were involved in politics, two things happened. Number one, some of them got sucked into politics and became corrupted. Number two, they really didn't achieve a lot of their objectives. The social conservatives did not overturn Roe versus Wade. They did not bring back prayer in school. Now you could argue that they prevented other bad things from happening, and that's probably true.
But there are some nativity scenes in town centers, I believe.
Yes. But you could argue that for all the support they gave the Republican Party, they didn't get a lot out of it, except for some of their leaders becoming corrupted and essentially becoming, the whole thing is, with being a Christian, not the whole thing, but one of the big things is of course, being in this world but not of this world. And so I'm not advising people of faith to leave politics. What I am saying is it is incredibly seductive and you have to guard your heart and be very careful. And I think right now it's maybe tougher than ever, because I think if you're a Christian conservative, it's very easy to get sucked into the war thing, into that war mentality, and to where you essentially see the left as an enemy that must be destroyed, and you must be willing to do whatever it takes to do that. And at some point, you will become more political. The Christian conservative will become more about politics than about their faith. Now, look, people will get mad at me for talking about William Wilberforce, but I'm going to do it one more time because I think it's so important, because I think he's a great model. So Wilberforce became, he at some point had a religious conversion and became an evangelical Christian. Now, Wilberforce didn't just do politics. He also started animal rights crusades, all sorts of stuff that progressives should like. And so he wanted to leave politics because he feared that it would be corrupting. And this guy Newton, I think it's John Newton, the guy who wrote the song Amazing Grace, Saved a Wretch Like Me, the guy who wrote that song talked him into staying involved in politics and said, you can do good here. So don't leave, don't abandon it. And of course, Wilberforce led this like 30-year crusade to end the British slave trade. And so here's an example of a guy who had this strong faith and used it to bring about a positive good. So I think it's possible. It's certainly possible. And look, if Christians left politics, what would be left in politics are people who aren't Christians. I mean, even if you're just you're not a believer, but for the sake of diversity, I think it's healthy to have some of them around, right? So I'm not advising anybody to leave. I'm just saying you have to be very, very careful. And I think that the ethos on the right now is especially worrisome. And I think as a result, you're seeing a lot of young millennial evangelicals. Maybe they're not even consciously deciding this, Bill, but just sort of coming to the conclusion that politics is not for them. And they're checking out.
Well, let's shift to some of the latest developments in the shutdown impasse, the debt limit impasse. I see on your Twitter feed you're being very hard on Obama. You're accepting the Boehner line that he's willing to negotiate and Obama's not. But there's a little bit of nervousness on the Democratic side that Obama is publicly entertaining a short-term debt increase followed by budget negotiations. Just as refusing to do it before debt limit increase occurs, whereas other Democrats and the bill that's pending in the Senate, from what I understand, is a long-term debt limit increase that would go through 2014 beyond the midterm election, and so it's a little fuzzy how firm the White House position is on that, but it seems like he's at least entertaining something shorter than that. And you also have today an op-ed by Paul Ryan. And a side note, my parents called me the other day saying, "Who was Mitt Romney's vice president again?" I had to think for a couple seconds.
He has been dormant out
late. So Ryan's back. He's still House Budget Chair. He has an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal laying out his suggested way out of the impasse, which as some folks on the right have noted, doesn't even mention Obamacare. It talks about entitlement reform. It talks about certain tweaks to Medicare, to federal federal worker pensions, to oil development, and it would appear revenue neutral tax reform. And some folks, I believe the folks at NBC First Read said this is sort of maybe a first step off of the ledge. The tone is different. It talks about the importance of keeping the government open and raising the paying our bills, which is sort of language that Obama uses in terms to the debt limit. But I would also note it doesn't have an actual concession. It's a changing of the demands, it doesn't say we would raise the debt limit without condition. It doesn't actually say we would accept a tax increase in exchange for things that we want. It's still a different demand without actually going as far as saying here's what we would trade.
Obama gets to go down in history as not being the first president to allow a nation to default. How about that?
Well, again, that's the question. Is that considered a win for Obama, or is just maintaining normal status quo, government open, we pay our bills, should be seen as a kind of victory for everything? Most folks on the Democratic side say that's not the Republicans should be rewarded for doing the basics of the job. And that's been what Obama's line has been. That's why I say I'm happy to negotiate all these things once you do your basic job.
I think the problem for Obama right now, and Bill, you know, the context, of course, is I was a huge skeptic of the defund strategy. But I think that things have changed. We went from Republicans being the ones taking an indefensible position, which is we're going to allow the government to shut down unless you defund your landmark legislation, to now Obama being the one who is really taking a sort of indefensible position, which is I'm not going to talk, I'm not going to negotiate. Look, even if you buy the argument, even if you concede that Republicans are petulant, childish, then you should still want the president to be the leader, the president to be the adult, and the adult would be willing to talk and compromise and avoid catastrophe. He's certainly not, as of now, rising to that occasion. So I guess you have two sides that are both acting petulantly.
Well, I don't think we have evidence yet that the public sees Obama as indefensible. He has not taken the poll hit yet.
If some sort of catastrophic, you know, default were to take place, I'm pretty sure that nobody looks good in that instance.
Well, I think you can look at the polling and say there's evidence that nobody looks good right now. I mean, Obama's ratings are not, you know, going through the roof or anything like that. But I think it's clear to say the Republicans are taking the biggest hit, taking the lion's share of the blame here. And this is why
if I were Obama, I would be thinking these guys are a joke. They are acting like children. But I'm the president, and I'm in charge here, and we're not going to default on my watch. And, you know, let's give them a chance to work this out. I'm going to at least talk to them and see if we can come to some sort of an accommodation so that they can save face and we can move on and actually fix this economy. I mean, that's what I would do as a leader, as someone who cares deeply about this country.
I think you're a little premature in assuming that's not what's going to eventually happen.
Let's hope. I mean, I hope that's what happens eventually.
But I think where you and he are diverging is just in the timing of getting to that point, and where I think, you know, where the wannabe Alinskyites have miscalculated is, you know, Obama gets to take the longer view because he is not up for re-election. I mean, people went into saying, well, we played this card in 2011 and he came around and talked to us, so he'll do it again. He had to run for re-election a year later. If the economy went down in 2011, Obama loses. And now Obama doesn't have to worry about that short-term political consequence, and Republicans do.
Yeah, but don't you think, I mean, I guess a couple things there. I mean, number one, he should be worried about his legacy. I mean, he should want to go down in history as a transformational president, like he talked about Reagan being, but Clinton wasn't. So his legacy is important. Number two, I just think the fiduciary responsibility to this nation, regardless of whether or not his political hide is on the line for re-election, should outweigh those considerations. So, you know, I don't know. I don't buy that. I don't buy that argument. I think he's got plenty of incentive.
I don't think Obama is itching for a default. It's just that he can stand pat for longer because the worst case scenario hurts Republicans more than him. He would obviously rather not have a default.
See, I think the fact that he's a lame duck should make this deal easier. Because look at it this way. If I start my first day of school and some kid comes up and says, give me your money, your lunch money, I've got a problem. Because I'm going to see this kid every day for the next 4 years. Can't give him my lunch money every day. On the other hand, you're on the metro and the kid says, give me your lunch money. You may never see that guy again. You know, my point here is Obama shouldn't worry that much about setting a precedent that he's going to be shaken down by these guys. In fact, what about this Gephardt rule? We haven't talked about this. I think, you know, Obama could if I were Obama, I might consider making all sorts of concessions in exchange for returning the Gephardt rule. For those who don't know, that would mean that the debt ceiling is raised automatically, which means we wouldn't have to go through this process every so often. It would just, whenever Congress approves spending, it would be tied, the debt ceiling would be raised automatically. Why doesn't, you know, I wonder if Obama would consider that if he's really worried about this happening again. That's
I think that miscalculates what Obama ultimately wants here. He doesn't just want status quo. I mean, I think he still wants to get things in his last 3 years in office. And the things that are pending on his agenda that are you know, remotely attainable is some kind of budget agreement that involves additional tax revenue, mostly from corporations, and immigration reform.
Asking for tax increases of Republicans is tantamount to asking to repeal Obamacare.
Republicans can't whine and complain that Obama won't negotiate and then say taxes are off the table. That is contradictory. Either everything's on the table or it's not.
Is Obamacare on the table? I mean, it's not.
Obama has said that he's willing to talk about health care. I don't think gutting the entire law is on the table because that's been very well legislated and litigated, but I think Obama is open to talk about more health care reforms. He has said that. But I think Obama wants that. I think Obama wants immigration reform. I think Obama wants to restructure deficit reduction so it's more backloaded than front-loaded and hope to get some upfront stimulus for jobs. Like, those are the things that he would like to have and probably doesn't have much hope for a lot of it beyond immigration. But to get just finish it off, the only way he gets to any of that is to neutralize the Tea Party faction. They have to be disempowered. And the only way you disempower them is to hold the line on this deadline. I mean, that's why you don't cave in now, because then you get none of that.
Well, I think that's fascinating. And I think it's indicative of the crisis that we're facing, because you are saying that the smart move here is to take a really hardline approach and not cave. And I think Republicans on the other side have a similar attitude that we've got him, or we've got to take this hard line. So both sides believe that the smart play here is to go to the cliff. So this thing really could go off the cliff. Look, I'll tell you this now. I think there's like 0% chance. Well, zero is a small number. There's a 1% chance that Republicans agree to raise taxes or for immigration reform anytime soon. I'm not saying it'll never happen again. I'm saying anytime soon. So That is.
I think I think it's pretty clear that Boehner won't allow default to happen. I think he's made that pretty clear.
So you think you believe that because you know what he will not have enough Republican votes to prevent it.
I don't think that's
well,
true.
Let me back up. I'm making a big assumption here, and I shouldn't. I'm assuming that the debt ceiling and the CR are rolled into one thing.
They
may not be. And look, there are people like Eric Erickson who are arguing, just raise the debt ceiling. Just go ahead and do that. Let's make the fight over the government shutdown. And that is where we have to hold firm on, you know, repealing Obamacare. But don't come close to default. Don't come close to, you know, a shutdown. Then, of course, the other thing, Bill, that complicates matters and is this notion floated by people like Senator Pat Toomey, who's a very smart conservative, former head of the Club for Growth, who says, look, you know, you just prioritize, you know, paying the principal. We don't have to raise the debt ceiling and it, you know, right away, and it's not going to cause the government to default. We can just essentially pay our bills. And, you know, Pat Toomey is a smart conservative. This isn't some fringe House member saying that. But it's not accepted
by the Treasury Department or most economists. That you can pick and choose your payments.
There are people who say that it's illegal to do that or simply not possible to do it logistically. Do we want to find out? I don't think we want to find out.
Well, that's why I think let's get back to the politics of this. I mean, you can talk about whether you know the Tea Party's recalcitrance or Boehner's general timidity, but I think Boehner knows, I think most Republicans know, that actual default is the worst possible thing that could happen to Republicans in 2014. That would risk the actual loss of the House, not to mention the blowing the chances of taking over the Senate. So this is why I find the whole strategy of taking the debt limit hostage by the Republicans is putting the gun to their own political heads, which is why that's not tenable and sustainable. So if the Democrats hold the line, you now have a bill in the pipeline of the Senate that would extend the debt limit, you know, for, you know, more than a year, which if Republicans do nothing and you're coming up to the deadline, I know there's now a debate what the actual deadline is, so that's tricky, but whatever Boehner thinks the deadline is, he is going to have to either make a bigger concession to get a short-term debt limit increase, or if he's right up against the midnight hour, he's going to have no choice but to accept the Senate bill that's sitting in his lap. And once he does that, which would have to get passed without Tea Party votes, it would get passed with Democratic votes and a chunk of Republicans, that opens up the door to so many other things for Obama.
Let me say real quick. I think I misrepresented the Toomey thing. It's to prioritize interest payments.
Right.
Point one. Point two. Am I correct? It sounds like you're saying that you believe that Boehner will insist that the debt ceiling is raised and will take essentially whatever means necessary to do that. Is that correct?
I believe that, yes. I mean, I can't prove it till we hit that point, but that's my sense. I'm betting that's Obama's sense, too.
All right, so third question. Let's say Boehner doesn't do that. Do you believe that Barack Obama would allow the October 17th deadline or whenever it is to come and go without, I hate to say cave, because honestly, I don't think that negotiations constitute caving. But do you believe that he is willing to let this thing play out and risk potential default?
I mean, I'm only going on what I've seen them say publicly and what news reports indicate they're saying privately. I mean, it's all I have to work with. You know, I mean, there's actual reporting that Boehner has told people privately, we won't let default happen. And, you know, Obama...
Right, but when they say that, that might mean the Toomey idea. The default's not going to happen.
Well, I mean, it still means they have to pass something. I mean Boehner has
Toomey
to
has a bill, but there's a... Toomey has a bill that would prioritize the paying of interest payments. So, you know... So
I would suspect Obama would take that as a deal breaker, because the problem is you can't do anything.
It's like the
that's
faith in full credit call into, or something.
Yeah, full faith and credit, which that's to Obama is an up is down type of bill title, because you're putting into the bloodstream the notion that America is going to pick and choose payments someday in the future, and that calls into question the full faith and credit of the American government. That's what they want to avoid. So I'm sure they would send out a veto threat message very early to Boehner. That doesn't count. You're not going to – if your concern is preventing default, that's not going to work. If you think default's going to happen, we're going to get blamed for it, go ahead. But default's going to happen if you do it that way.
Well, man, things are going to get interesting, and real quick, right? I mean, I have the sense. Well, before I talk to you, let me say that I'm a little concerned now. But before our conversation today, I did have the sense that the fever was breaking a little bit, that they were gonna, you know, find a way to like kick the can down the road, and nobody will really win this thing, but crisis averted kind of deal like they always do. And now I'm a little bit more pessimistic, I think.
can I tell a random anecdote?
Please.
So when I was in college, I went to a very liberal hippie college.
Well, you went to Oberlin, right?
I went to Oberlin with Michelle
this
Malkin.
This is Lena Dunham's college.
That's right. And when you're in the dorms at Oberlin, I assume it's still this way. It was, you know, 20 plus years ago. For the first day of your dorm, you have a dorm meeting where you vote on will the showers be co-ed and will the sinks and bathroom stalls be co-ed? And you have a group discussion, and it's essentially a secret ballot. Your eyes are closed and your hands are up, and only like the RAs count the votes. But if one person on a floor rejected co-ed, then it was rejected. It had to be unanimous consent. Senate rules, you know. And so, you know, in my junior year, I'd been around the block. I had concluded what I was comfortable with, what I was not comfortable with. And I said, and I was in a dorm where the showers had no stalls. It's a gang shower, okay? So I said up front, I'm telling the dorm on my floor, second floor, the showers will be single sex. I'm informing you of this. I'm not going to budge. Proceed with the rest of the discussion knowing that I am going to vote for the gang showers to be single sex. First floor, third floor, sinks and stalls, do what you want. Know that. And immediately all the attention, you know, came down on me. Why is this heterosexist, you know, cretin dictating the shower policy for the rest of the dorm?
You were thought to be conservative.
That's right. I was conservative, campus conservative back then. For things like this, this is the Overton window that I was dealing with.
The Overton window becomes the Oberlin window. Right.
And so all the negotiation then turns to me. What will I accept? Will you accept if it is co-ed, you know, 3 days a week? No. Will you accept if there is a spinner that you see if there's a boy or a girl in the shower at a given time? No. You know, he just went on and on for hours. I was like, just move on. I have taken this position. Just proceed. I did it because I wanted the meeting to end early so I could watch The Simpsons, and it backfired in that respect. I was there for 2 hours, but I did not budge. And I feel like Obama here has been pretty clear. Whereas, I mean, I think, you know, Ted Cruz has been clear, but Boehner has not. There's plenty of lack of clarity on the Republican side what they're going to accept. Whereas Obama, the Democrats, have been very, very clear. No conditions on debt limit. So at some, and the only reason you would think that he would be moved off of that position is if there would be some kind of political force to move them off it. I mean, to your point, if he was being deemed as imminently unreasonable by the public, and that was going to hurt, you know, Mark Pryor in Arkansas, and hurt Mark Begich in Alaska, and then those folks started to wobble.
But you're saying that his only responsibility are essentially political responsibility. My position is, and we've been talking about this since Obama got elected, although not as much lately. But my position essentially is that when you become the president of the United States, it is incumbent upon you to be the adult. And even if other people are acting childish, the buck stops there. And it may not be the best negotiating place to be. Maybe it's better for people to think that you're willing to be irresponsible or that you're crazy or that you're stubborn. But at the end of the day, part of the reason, when we elect a president, we're sort of electing them to kiss ass, to get things done, and to protect us, to watch out for us, and to be willing to humble himself a little bit for our sake. And he's not doing that right now. He's not willing to do that.
Well, I mean,
maybe he's being responsive to the Democratic Party, but he's the president of the United States.
I mean, I think you look at the history of Obama, this is a guy who he compromised with Republicans, twice on taxes. There was the initial tax cut deal in 2010. He had a more favorable deal, you know, at the end of 2012, but still had to give up something. Couldn't get everything that he wanted. They did the Budget Control Act in 2011, which essentially was, we're going to have deficit reduction one way or the other, whether it's by supercommittee or by sequester, but we're going to cut the deficit. And he stuck to that. He hasn't pushed to unravel the sequester, you know, the guy has shown a perfect capability to having reasonable negotiation with the other party. And even in this year, he has offered a deal where he trades chain CPI for corporate tax increases. So it's not like he hasn't put anything on the table here. And they're even offering to keep the government open at sequester levels, which a lot of Democrats don't want to do. So it's not like there is zero openness here. I mean, there is a hardened position on debt limit increase without conditions, but it's just that. Everything else, there's tons of flexibility to work with. So I don't feel it's fair to say, I mean, you could argue that maybe that one position is enough if a default happens. I mean, but you can't really judge that till we see how this all plays out. I think the combination of that one hard position with lots of other opportunities for flexibility elsewhere is not a juvenile position to take. I mean, it's much more juvenile to say, we only pass a debt limit with every item on our Republican wish list or nothing. That's a much more juvenile position.
They're not the president.
They're part of the governing structure. They count. They have to act like adults too.
Yeah, I just think that there's a special responsibility and trust placed in the president. I will be very curious to see how he is remembered by history, what his legacy is. He's obviously a historic president, and obviously Obamacare is a huge landmark legislation. But it'll be interesting to see how history remembers this sort of thing.
Now, I was trying to think about this. What other presidents have dealt with this kind of opposition? And forgive me, I haven't thoroughly researched it, so excuse me if I don't encompass everybody in the past 100 years. But you know, Clinton had the House Republicans, the Gingrich Revolution. He faced impeachment.
They wanted to impeach Reagan over Iran-Contra.
Well, they got the Iran-Contra hearings, but there was a lot more bipartisan cooperation.
George H.W. Bush voted to raise taxes, and James Carville called it the most famous broken promise in American history.
Well, that was bipartisan.
And used it against him, campaigned against him because he was willing to compromise.
Well, you could say Democrats who coaxed him into the deal then crapped all over him. You could argue that, but that wasn't a hard and wall opposition. They cut a deal, and there was 86 tax reform, you know, under Reagan, as well as earlier things in his first term. That Iran-Contra was not a wall of opposition there. You know, it was some hardball at that point. I think, Harry Truman got almost nothing out of his fair deal package. There was a lot of resistance there. JFK had a bunch of stuff done, but he didn't get civil rights on his watch, didn't get Medicare. But I think the ultimate obstruction was Woodrow Wilson and League of Nations. I mean, there are other things that passed when Republicans took over.
Woodrow Wilson, William Wilberforce, W's. Have we had enough of these W guys?
Heard it's relevant. About. It's they're both relevant history. I mean, so here's a case.
The commenters beg to disagree.
In Truman's case, he is still remembered for the policy of containment. You know, so he has a foreign policy legacy. So you don't remember the fact that almost all of his domestic reforms got squelched. You remember that a foreign policy philosophy that lasted for decades. With Clinton, right now you remember you actually with Clinton, I think he has less policy accomplishments to lean on. But people remember that the economy was good back then. He did get his tax increase early in his term.
Good.
What's that?
The economy was good.
The economy was good. I mean, he has that, and he overcame impeachment. So impeachment doesn't define the entire legacy. A lot of JFK's big agenda items that got blocked got passed by LBJ, so that gets covered over somewhat. But with Wilson, even though he had a number of policy accomplishments that are very significant in the first term, you created the Federal Reserve, established the first income tax. And even foreign policy wise, set the precedent that America is engaged internationally, is not isolationist. That essentially began with Wilson. The defeat of the League of Nations, you know, really is a huge cloud. I mean, it's partially redeemed by the fact that his vision won out under FDR and the UN. But it really sullies the record. That he had this idea, he painstakingly negotiated personally with the other great powers, but could not sell it to the Republican Senate. And so, to get right to your point, you know, if Obama holds tough and Boehner blinks, that only adds to Obama's legacy. He was the strong leader, and he got the opposition to crack and got some stuff that he wanted. If the default happens, yeah, that would probably be a major sullying of the overall record. I'm sure it's not his preferred choice, but if what goes along with it is the Republicans also self-immolate and Democrats control Congress for the foreseeable future and win future presidencies, a lot of Obama policies are going to be retained. It's a question of they're both pretty bad scenarios. But I think Obama would take the latter if Republicans give him very little choice.
Scary stuff, Bill. Mm. I guess we're out of time. I'm going to go self-immolate right now. Always good talking with you, even though it was depressing. I always learn stuff, so that's good.
I'm happy about that. We'll talk next week.
You got it, man.
Bye. Yeah. Next week we'll be right up against what may be the debt limit deadline. So it'll be an exciting week. We're living interesting times, where everyone always wants.
Tune in.
See ya. Take care.